Fourth case for this morning is number 102184, United States against Marvin, not sure how he pronounces his name, Pugh. Mr. Ackerman.
Thank you.
Morning.
Court, please. My name is Alan Ackerman. I represent the appellant.
Wait until you're up here so we can make sure that Judge Rovner hears everything.
I want to hear every word.
Every word you say. You
know, Judge Rovner, you're fibbing. And I'm wearing my bar mitzvah suit.
Yes.
I just want you to know that.
Judge Rovner, he's actually dressed in a suit with a tie. Very looks very businesslike.
Has he been told he's dying?
May I present an applicant for a candidate for the Illinois Bar who has the poor judgment to ask me for a job? His name is Cody. Cody. He just took the bar and he wanted to see what the Court of Appeals was like.
Well, welcome. Court,
please. My name is Alan Ackerman, counsel for the government. Marvin Pugh, and with your permission, I'll call him Marvin for the purpose of the argument, just to be simple, complains that he was deprived of a fair trial and a fair sentencing. The facts, frankly, are not largely disputed, save for the fact that Marvin maintains, as he did when he testified, that he did not tell the president of the state bank, Doug Cross, that the granary was producing its own corn or soybeans. The evidence is that Doug Cross is the only witness to testify that Marvin Pugh may have said that we are producing or growing grain. The fact of the matter is it doesn't much matter, because what happened here is deceptively simple. The government took, and interestingly, at page 3, paragraph 3 of the indictment, the grand jury charges that the defendants, meaning Marvin and his cousin Stephen Howell, acquired, renewed, and maintained a loan.
But here, if you're going in the direction of whether this is a duplicitous or a multiplicitous problem. Multiplicity was not argued in the district court. So
that is
the
correct.
Best you can do is plain error on that. And the government has a fairly simple theory that each count relates to a different extension of credit. We have the $2 million, we have another $200,000 or whatever it was that I'm not gonna get the number. Yeah, $2,200,000 and then finally $350,000. Those look like three different extensions of a line of credit to me, each one has a different factual background.
Judge Wood, the difference is, are they separate executions or are they acts in furtherance of the single scheme?
Right, and what the, I mean, it doesn't seem to me, especially on plain error grounds, that it's too much to say that, you know, it could have been stopped after each one of these. It seems to me that calling them separate executions is a perfectly reasonable thing to do.
Well, having heard that, I'll go.
You don't need to agree with me.
That,
I'm just inviting your response.
Particularly when we look at the dates of the counts, Mr. Ackerman. One happened in mid-January 99.
Correct.
One happened in February of 2000, and another 4 months later in June.
Correct. What occurred here is, look, Stephen Howell and Marvin are first cousins. Stephen's father, Harlan, is a well-to-do central Illinois landowner and farmer. Somehow they all got together and Stephen's father said, look, folks, you guys want to go into business, I'll fund you. And they did. So in roughly 1996 and 1997, they opened up triple corporations, Agritech, Agridawn, and the Granary.
So could I just ask you, I mean, I actually got so confused reading some of this cross-examination of Mr. Ha. I thought it was in a Monty Python skit or something. It was really, It seems to me there's a circle of arrangements, and Agritech is a company, and correct me at any point where I've got this wrong, which may be the whole thing, but Agritech is a company that provides various services to farmers and growers and whatever. And Agritech does things for its customers, and this is the part of it that it looked to me like these were just on verbal arrangements. The district court wanted to call it the verbal contracts. Then, at another part of my triangle, the customers are selling grain to the granary, which is one of the companies that you just said
correct
they created. I thought the problem was in the third side, where Agritech is engaged in futures transactions somehow that relate to the granary, and that it was at least the government's theory that these were actually non-existent transactions. They were just on the books and used to give the banks a false impression of assets that weren't really there, and hence the fraudulent aspect of things. And, of course, the check kiting is a separate theory. Is that at least a somewhat correct description of what's going on?
Your Honor is insightful. Waded through a barrel of trivia and basically came to the correct conclusion.
All right. So why isn't it a jury question see whether that third leg that I'm calling it, the Agritech to granary leg, is real or false?
Because the whole concept here, the government was looking to prosecute something 8 years after the fact or 9 years after the fact. They closed in August of 2000. The indictment is returned in 2008, late 2008. All right. I think the court should ask itself a question, and the first question the court might want to ask itself is, wait a second, what's so important here that 8 years down the road we would be charging somebody for an alleged claimed bank loan application executed in 1999 or June of 2000? Well, there is no simple answer here because there was no prosecution in the interim.
Well, maybe the simple answer is that financial fraud is a big problem
well,
in our society.
That carries the assumption that Marvin Pugh participated in the fraud. Here you have what has happened here. State Bank, i.e. Doug Cross, was stuck now. He's stuck because he gave the granary $2 million+. What is he going to do? He looks bad for everyone. But he had.
In the meantime, the granary goes bankrupt. I mean, as you point out.
Okay. Yeah. And now State Bank, Doug Cross,
under review,
sues everybody.
Right.
Doug Bank Cross failed. Sues everybody, including Harlan Howell and Bernard Reese, the octogenarian who said that the granary were all crooks and thieves anyway. And that is what the linkage is here, the only linkage. Doug Cross says, wait a second, I didn't understand that Agritech may have been selling its grain to the granary. Something is wrong here. Well, the fact of the matter is, nothing was hidden from him, as he testified. There were CPAs, independent, hired by the bank, who testified, or at least Doug Cross acknowledged that. And nothing was ever hidden. The state of Illinois came in every year, and it was only open 96, 97, 98, and part of 2000.
But what about these contracts between Agritech and the granary? Now, obviously, in the world, you know, hypothetically, sometimes companies buy grain contracts, you know, to deliver in November or whatever they might have. And they might then turn around and resell those contracts to somebody else. Or maybe they actually buy physical grain, and you could do that. But what's the evidence that these contracts were really legitimate contracts?
There's nothing illegitimate. If I'm a grain seller, a grain producer, a land owner, I can come to whomever it is, the granary, and ask if they want to purchase my grain.
But what the government says at page 5 of its brief, and I'm sure they'll be glad to explain further, is they say available granary records revealed no Agritech grain deliveries to the granary or granary payments to Agritech for the purchase of grain. Stephen confirmed that Agritech never delivered any grain to the granary to fulfill the contracts, and they say they never intended. So, some money has to change hands or something has to happen.
Agritech did the custom farming for the landowner. They were the turnkey operation.
But you agreed a few minutes ago that there were at least futures contracts or something. There was some business arrangement between Agritech and the granary.
I'd be glad to do my best to try and explain it as I can. And truly, it is just this way. I, Agritech, Steve Howell, go take care of the land for whomever. The 200 acres.
These are the oral contracts, yes.
And at the time of harvest, typically the landowner or farmer will say to the people who did the work, what can I get for the crop? What's it worth? And Steve would say, well, talk to Marvin. Marvin's the maven. So Marvin then would talk to the landowner. Now, how Agritech is involved in this is just a shell game. But the fact is, I'm the landowner.
Stay in front of the microphone for Judge Rovner, please.
I'm the farmer. I got my money. Nobody stole my money.
But these are the contracts between the customers and the granary. And as far as I know, nobody has any problem with them.
Exactly. There is not one farmer who came in and said to the jury, hey, wait a second, these people never paid me. Quite to the contrary, all this comes about because Marvin provided between 70% and 80% of the futures price for the farmer.
But then when Agritech goes to the bank to get its line of credit,
Granary.
Granary is the one with the line of credit?
Oh, yes, granary, not Agritech. And this is how far it goes. None of that should have happened, but for the fact that Stephen was writing the checks from the granary.
No, I know there's that siphoning theory you have, but the granary shows the bank contracts with Agritech.
Granary,
part of its showing of what its assets are. That's again, I thought you agreed a few minutes ago that was the government's theory.
Oh, there were.
That they say to the bank, we're a good risk for a $2 million line of credit because here are these receivables or whatever, you know, I don't know what I want to call them, but here are these contracts. And in fact, they were fictional.
They were never fictional, is the point. If you took Agritech out of it, nothing changes.
Now,
that's the whole point.
Pew prepared those contracts, which were submitted to the bank, which stated that Agritech was committed to selling grain in the granary.
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear you.
But Pew prepared the contracts, right, that were submitted to the bank, and the contracts that stated that Agritech was committed to selling grain to the granary.
Sure, all right. Absolutely.
And the government's theory is that when he submitted it to the bank, he knew Agritech was never going to fulfill its obligation under the contract.
Agritech could buy grain from anyone.
When the bank wanted more information about it, Pew said that Agritech was going to produce the grain that it was going to sell to the granary.
The Cross is the only one out of 68 witnesses or 52 witnesses who ever said that Marvin said, we are going to produce. The only one. Even Steve Howell, the government's witness, and his cousin.
But Agritech neither produces nor goes out in the market and buys and then delivers anything to the granary. The only thing the granary gets is from the customers, from this other group that Agritech has been providing services to.
I beg to differ with the court, but I have
Well, at least that's what I understand. You know, we'll ask the government. We just, at the moment, I think, speaking for myself maybe, am trying to understand what went on in this transaction and who was doing what when. At that point, inferences can be drawn, but it's not been made easy.
May I have a moment for sentencing?
Why don't you? I will let you address sentencing on your rebuttal.
All right. Thank you.
Give you some time.
Thank you.
All right. You have a heavy burden, Mr. Love, of clarifying everything in the space of 15 minutes.
I'll do my utmost.
And before you get into the particulars, this delay issue that Mr. Ackerman raised, what's your response to that?
I don't want to be flip, Your Honor, but by the same token, I don't know what the point of it is. We get to cases in the best time that we can. I could run through chronologically with the court assignments and reassignments of case agents, prioritizing of cases within our office, within my caseload, timing of it being assigned. But there's nothing that indicates that there's some inappropriate intent that was the motivation behind this prosecution. May it please the court. Let me make one quick point, and then I will try and take the court through the facts if I appreciate what the court has asked me to do. Counsel made the point Agritech could buy grain from anyone. The testimony of the defendant's own expert, Mr. Clarence Grant, was clearly to the contrary. And it points out one of the reasons why these sham Agritech contracts are so unbelievable on their face. And not in a normal business, not the way businesses such as this would do business. And that is because in the state of Illinois, for anybody to buy grain from the producer of grain, the actual grower of the grain, they must hold a grain dealer's license. What that means then is that Agritech could only buy from other grain dealers, which means that Agritech, in order to fulfill those contracts, were it even, and the defendant, Mr. Pugh, testified that this was not what they were going to do, but even if he had intended to do that at some point, it would have been a transaction that would have been Agritech buying from one grain dealer and reselling to another to fulfill the contracts.
And you're saying everybody in that chain would have to have this kind of license? The person from whom Agritech purchased, Agritech itself, and the person to whom Agritech sold?
Agritech was not a producer.
Right.
So it could buy only from grain dealers.
Okay, so it's limited to its potential sources.
Yes.
To grain dealers.
Only to
okay.
grain dealers, not from its own customers. Agritech could not buy the grain from its own customers. In order for the customer's grain to be marketed at the granary, they had to skip over Agritech because it didn't have a grain dealer's license.
Because it couldn't have sold to the granary without a grain dealer's license? Is that?
No, it could sell to the granary. I mean, once it's the owner of grain that it has purchased from a grain dealer,
mm-hmm.
then it can sell to another grain dealer.
Okay. Customers have grain dealer's licenses?
I'm sorry?
Did the customers have grain dealer licenses so they could sell to the granary?
These were just producers, Your Honor, just average farmers. There's nothing in the record to that effect, but nothing that would indicate they were otherwise either.
Mm-hmm.
It is a fairly simple thing. Agritech was a company that simply grew grain for landowners. It was paid in cash. It got paid on a per-acre basis. If it plowed 50 acres and charged $20 an acre for plowing, it got a check for that. That was the extent of its business. Did it offer grain marketing services? Yes, and I think Mr. Ackerman accurately described that when he said Mr. Hollowell would tell customers, go talk to Mr. Pugh at the granary, effectively cutting Agritech out of it as it had to be cut out because it was not a grain dealer. What the defendant testified to was that at the very beginning of the granary's existence, with Agritech and having expected customers that they would do business for and who would then market their grain through the granary, the defendant testified he wanted to have contracts on the books of the granary so that he could have good sales prices to offer to the customers of Agritech. What did that require him to do? This is another reason why we know that he deviated so substantially from any normal business practice for a grain dealer. He came into Agritech in 1996, and what did he do? He wrote hundreds of thousands of bushels of contracts for Agritech to sell to the granary. Like any grain dealer, he had to do the offsets. There's plenty of testimony in the record that says, hey, you got to offset this grain. Okay? Now, what position is the granary in at that time? And at every day thereafter through their closing, they were in a position where their seller, the person that the granary was going to buy supposedly this grain from, had no enforceable obligation, didn't know from year to year how many producers it would, or how many clients or customers Agritech would have and how many bushels would be available, didn't get the grain and was forced to roll over these contracts for 4 years, which there was testimony about being very unusual in the industry. It created an incredible financial liability for the granary that eventually broke it in 2000 when prices just went so far different than what their contracts were, it led them into this cash problem.
That's when they start the check kiting and so on?
That's correct. That's correct, Your Honor.
So is it the offsets that are putting this tremendous pressure on the granary?
Margin calls.
Margin calls, yeah. Okay.
Margin calls because of all of these hundreds of thousands of bushels that have been sold, but the contract's not cleared. The defendant testified on...
I have a tiny little question for you. He was acquitted on counts 1 and 2. Can he be made to pay restitution for the losses to the law in those counts?
Yes, Your Honor. I think I understand the question whether or not he can be made to pay restitution on counts 1 and 2. And my understanding of the law on that is that no, he cannot. And we have not argued that he can be. But we have argued that the count of conviction, count 3, is a scheme that is of the same breadth as what was described in counts 1 and 2, so that under count 3, he can be required to pay restitution for the entire scheme, which does include the loan that was referenced in count 2.
So your answer is yes and no.
As I understand his answer, and I had a similar question, it seems to be drawing a distinction between relevant conduct in the 1B1.3 sense of the term and a scheme in as that term is used in the guidelines and the statutes. And the scheme in this particular instance looks a lot like the conduct that's charged in those other counts on which he's acquitted.
That's correct, Your Honor, and that's the theory.
The government really has them going, coming and going, doesn't it?
Yes, it does.
I'm sorry, I didn't...
She said you've got them coming and going. She said the government has them coming and going. But...
And I have another question. Did Savannah Bank incur any actual losses in connection with the overdraft payments?
No, they did not.
Because I know the uncle repaid the amount.
That's correct, Your Honor. Harlan Hollowell, the father of Stephen, under no legal obligation, voluntarily repaid. Yes. Are there areas of the facts that I'm not sure whether I've moved through the facts and satisfactorily for the court?
No, I think that's fine. Yeah. I mean, maybe we can talk, unless somebody else has questions, we can turn to other sentencing issues. The restitution, the obstruction, and I know Mr. Ackerman would like to raise the Demaree issue. It's certainly briefed, so if you have something you'd like to say about that. Things have changed, of course, since this court originally came out with Demaree, and quite a few circuits have now lined up on the other side of that issue.
That's correct, Your Honor. As I said in the brief, which I think is still the situation under the case law, that the additional circuits who have followed Turner was examined by this court, and this court stuck with Demaree. I don't think that there's any new case law analysis that's come out.
The only thing that occurs to me is that, of course, I mean, obviously this court, if it wants to, can use our Rule 40E procedure, can reexamine if a majority of the judges wish to do so. And the thing that's striking is, well, two things are striking to me. One is that the Supreme Court continues to emphasize the critical importance in any criminal sentencing of beginning with an accurate calculation of the guidelines. And I looked at some statistics just yesterday suggesting that something in the neighborhood of 82% of all criminal cases wind up with guidelines sentences. The numbers have shifted a little bit since Booker, but that's the ballpark. And that's a lot of sentences. It suggests the guidelines have a lot of bite still. So there's that fact in the Supreme Court's insistence that the district court always be advised by a proper guideline calculation. And secondly, there's the idea from Garner against Jones, a Supreme Court's case, that the question isn't really whether somebody's bound to impose a harsher sentence, it might be whether there's a significant risk of prolonging incarceration. So if you combine the 82% figure that I suggested plus the significant risk idea, doesn't Turner make some sense?
If the court follows the guideline about making the legal ex post facto decision, which the court did in Demaree.
Right. I mean, Demaree builds on the fact that it's all discretionary, and so if it's discretionary, it's discretionary. But I'm saying there may be a more nuanced way to look at it.
Should the court want to revisit, that would be the court's choice.
Well, of course, but I mean, I'd be interested in your defense of Demaree if that's what you wish to do.
Well,
maybe you don't want to defend it. Maybe if the government is, I don't know if you've checked with the Attorney General, but we'll see.
Your Honor, I think Demaree was correctly decided. The guidelines changed in the interim, I think. And the court, having discretion, and I think this was one of the points that was made in Demaree, the court having discretion, this court was asked, I mean, the district court in this case was asked for a variance. And if the court felt that the guideline changes were unfair in some fashion, the district courts could certainly, he was aware of his discretion, could certainly have sentenced consistently with that opinion on his part. And I think that discretion is the essence of what came out of Booker.
Okay.
As to the restitution, Your Honor, the entire scheme that was described in counts 1, 2, and 3. There were three executions, and they were each charged in counts 1, 2, and 3. Only count 3 was a conviction. But the allegations, the description of the scheme itself is the same in count 3 as it is in counts 1 and 2.
But can you have it both ways? I mean, if it really is all the same scheme, then why isn't there a fairly apparent multiplicity problem?
This is a restitution issue as opposed to the charging aspect of it, number one.
But how compartmentalized is our thinking supposed to be? Wouldn't it make sense for it to be one or the other for all purposes?
I don't think in terms of multiplicity and restitution being the same. I think we do compartmentalize substantially. For instance, we compartmentalize loss and restitution. We don't have loss the same as restitution. So I do think that that compartmentalization is appropriate in these situations. The interest...
It just seems like you're talking out of two sides of your mouth.
Yes.
I mean, really, because, you know, for purposes of restitution, it's all one big scheme. But for purposes of charging the count, it's not. It should be separate. So it just... I don't know. I don't think the word is disingenuous, but it just seems like you're going down...
I hope it's not disingenuous.
You know, I know you're sincere in how you make an argument, but it does seem like you're turning it to fit your circumstance when you deal with the restitution. So why shouldn't we buy his argument on multiplicity?
When we charge these cases, we don't know which of the executions the jury is going to believe is an execution of the scheme. We can't know that in advance. And yet all of them, if they are under the law executions as opposed to acts in furtherance, ought to give us the opportunity to bring that separate execution for the jury to decide whether there's an execution and whether that was an execution of the scheme. I can't, it's almost, the reverse of it would be as much as saying that the jury's acquittals on counts 1 and 2 must be read as a rejection of those loans having been part of the scheme. But it doesn't have to be thus. It doesn't have to be that.
So what else would it be? It's not their rejection of the...
My feeling has always been that it was my mistake. I quantified the loss for count 3. We had an exhibit, 100C, where we had the difference in value. I've always felt that if I had quantified that and showed the jury on counts 1 and 2, it would have satisfied them more clearly with regard to materiality. We had general testimony from Mr. Duckworth regarding the fact that they were financial records of the granary showed an enhanced value as a result of the contracts, but I didn't reduce it. When it came to count 3, I did, and it was a $750,000 swing, and showed that they were, the granary had borrowed $750,000 more than it could have. That's been my personal theory about counts 1 and 2.
Now, if this had been a RICO indictment and the scheme had been charged in the first count of RICO, and one of the overt acts in RICO would have been these loans, and then there was a substantive count on these loans, 1 and 2, and there were acquittals on 1 and 2 in the substantive count. But of course, I guess that's different because RICO, all you need is one, isn't it? One overt act. But the jury makes a judgment on each.
That's my recollection.
Yeah. I was just trying to see if there was any parallel between it.
There are no further questions.
All right. Thank you.
Request
Mr.
Court.
Ackerman.
Thank you.
We'll give him 2 minutes.
The granary had both an Illinois and federal license, number one. Number two, the government has criticized the author of United States versus Brownell, which is cited in the opening and reply briefs, and claims that Brownell doesn't really state the law, and if it does, it's full of dicta.
As our chief judge frequently points out, the court speaks through its opinions. It's not individual judges.
Yes.
Having said that, though, the law of the case is simply that for restitution purposes, as we understand it at least, it's the counts of conviction, not the relevant conduct.
I think that's totally agreed. I think it's the fact that the government has thrown this additional concept, and to be fair, so do the application notes, of scheme into it. And scheme is something different from relevant conduct, and it's also different from perhaps count of conviction.
Thank you. The last thing, and I know you've given me 2 minutes, I'm not going to go over it. The disparity in sentencing, which was not touched on or briefly touched on, has to do with Damari. They blend together here, and it's overwhelming that Marvin should get 6 years, Stephen should get 1 year. They were partners and did the same thing.
Yep.
The difference, of course, Stephen testified as a prosecution witness.
Right.
That should not give rise to 5-year differences. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. Thanks to all counsel. We'll take the case under advisement.